Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 39, God is Love, Lover, and Beloved All at Once. Eastern and Western philosophies come from different starting points. With such dissimilar foundations at core, they have very different worldviews. Our Christian problem has been that we assume Jesus was a Westerner, when his Aramaic language and thought forms would have been much more similar to the East. It's no accident that Jesus lived in what we call the Middle East, on the cusp and under the control of Greek and Roman cultures, but surely not inside of them. Nonetheless, Western Christianity has understood and even pictured Jesus as if he were a European. Several central ideas affirmed by Jesus were already formed in the ancient Hindu Vedas, then unfolded by the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. In each case, notice that the mind revealed in these scriptures first sees things in their wholeness, whereas Westerners tend to first see things in their diversity. So in today's episode, we're going to introduce terms like Advaita, Karma, and Maya. The word Advaita is loosely translated having no duality, implying that the proper or spiritual way of understanding things is outside the realm of comparison or judgment. Advaita describes the non-dual or contemplative mind that understands things in their unity and connection before it separates them, not completely one, but not two either. Mirabai Starr says Advaita is not about everything being one big, mushy, homogeneous, tasteless thing. Rather, it's the subtle distinction that all things share the same ground of being, the same supreme reality that encompasses great diversity. At root, nothing is separate. Can you imagine that way? Westerners have a very hard time doing this until they are trained. First one, then two. First similarity, then dissimilarity. If you start with two, dissimilarity and distinction, it is almost impossible to ever get back to unity of consciousness or similarity, from which most compassion, or at least tolerance, proceeds. If you start with Advaita, you can still go back to making needed and helpful distinctions. But now love and union is prior to knowledge and information. That is the unique starting place of so many Eastern religions. We have moved closer to the Eastern understanding in our more recent use of the term karma, but it is still said like a joke, bad karma or good luck, or what goes around comes around, we might say in half jest. For the Hindu, karma is an inviolate law and is not just a clever aphorism. It is the nature of the universe and moves people toward purification of motive and honesty about why they are doing what they are doing. Karma is an absolute law of cause and effect. Even thoughts and desires have a predictable karma. You are responsible for your own thoughts and motives, and you cannot avoid the consequences. Thoughts and motives are real and create the real. You cannot walk around thinking negative thoughts, or they will destroy you. Conversely, no love is lost in the universe. I believe you are actually punished by your sins, whereas Western religions tend to teach that you are punished for your sins. Goodness is its own reward and evil is its own punishment, karmic law would say. These are two very different worldviews, and frankly, I am convinced that Jesus taught the karmic one. You cannot pick grapes from thorns or figs from thistles. A good tree will bear good fruit, he said, and a bad tree will bear bad fruit. See Matthew 7, verses 17 through 18. Jesus also said, if you show mercy, mercy will be shown to you. Matthew 5, 7 and Luke 6, 37. Also, the standard you use will be used for you. See Mark 4, 24. Jesus sought to create a deep sense of personal choice, responsibility, and freedom right now, and not just disconnected payoffs in the afterlife. But we have understood much of the gospel in terms of divine threats and artificial rewards, a delayed schedule of merits and demerits. This deeply distorted the transformative message of the gospel and appealed to our self-interest instead of love. In other words, it fed us at the ego level instead of at the soul level. I believe Jesus teaches that rewards and punishments for behavior are inherent and now, and only by karmic implication are they external and later. Karma, rightly understood, creates responsible and self-actualized people instead of fear-based people. Your choices matter now. Threats of punishment or promises of candy later create perpetual adolescence and very well-disguised narcissism at every level of Christianity. Let us take this moment to connect to the deep sense of personal choice, responsibility, and freedom right now. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The Hindu word Maya is often translated as illusion, but that doesn't get to the root of the insight and is too easily dismissed by the Western person who prefers to take things for what they are at face value. We might understand deceit, but we do not understand illusion very well. A better translation of Maya might be tricky. This understanding can have a truly transformative effect on how you live and die. When Hinduism, or Buddhism, which is a child of Hinduism, says all the worlds of forms is Maya, or emptiness, they are trying to help you look deeper, broader, and in the long term. If you recognize that what you first see is tricky, you might be more open to this better seeing. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it actually might not be a duck. It might be a goose, a swan, or a cartoon. The Upanishads illustrate Maya using the familiar experience of finding a rope on a path. You jump back, thinking it's a snake, but it isn't. Mirabai Star says, Wisdom comes with being able to engage in inquiry with curiosity, with childlike wonderment, as Jesus calls it, in order to see what really is and discover it's not something we have to defend ourselves against. Reality is hard but also benevolent. Hinduism is saying that all phenomenon passes themselves off as total and final in their independent and free existence. But just wait a while or look deeper and you will see that all things are part of a much larger ecosystem of connection and life. In their separateness, they will pass. Everything is qualified and provisional and contingent on something else. Anything that asserts its completely free and self-formed existence is lying to you. Everything from the self-made man to the myth of private property, to my rights over my body, to the pollution of the earth, these all proceed from a Western hubris which is not willing to admit and face its self-serving illusions. Morally speaking, the illusion of our separateness makes it hard for us to seek the common good. It is no surprise that the tragedy became the supreme form of both Greek and Shakespearean drama, which always ends in the sad results of human hubris. Yet, of the many arts in India, the tragedy is the only form India failed to produce. If you face illusions early, lasting and destructive tragedies are rare. Hubris is undercut at the very start. Jesus, of course, taught the same when he told us, "Take up the cross of this passing world and our own fragile lives." To begin to understand the ancient and many sources of Indian philosophy and Hinduism, which are often synonymous, are surely at the risk of immense oversimplification. So I will briefly introduce their primary sacred text. I'm going to elaborate with several key ideas that emerge from centuries of spiritual experience and reflection upon that experience. These ideas amount to the essential differences between Eastern and Western philosophies and show why some ideas of Eastern religions seem new or foreign, especially to Western believers. The Hindu sources clearly say contradictory things with what are surely conflicting ideas, but there's no need to perfectly harmonize them in the Eastern mind. They are each contributing their waters to a pool of wisdom that we can swim inside of and thus learn to honestly struggle with the conflict itself, which can be quite broadening, deepening, and enlightening. This is similar to the Jewish idea of Midrash and the Christian idea of Lectio Divina. If only we all could have approached the Bible and the Quran in the very same way, how different history would have been. Westerners lived in blissful ignorance that holy people and saints were already coming to our own later conclusion centuries before Jesus Christ. One would think that Christians would know that this does not in the least diminish Jesus, but in fact supports and affirms him. The three major texts in Hinduism and Indian philosophy are the Vedas, the Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita. The Vedas are the most ancient Sanskrit writings, as much as 3,000 or 4,000 years old, containing hymns, philosophy, guidance, and rituals. The Upanishads, which means what is learned sitting at the feet of, are later, 800 to 400 BC, and there are even more mystical texts which elaborate on many of the ancient themes. There are probably 13 major and many minor Upanishads. The Bhagavad Gita emerged in various translations from 4 centuries before Christ to 4 centuries after. It is an extended dialogue between Prince Arjuna, who is a passenger in a chariot, and Lord Krishna, who is teaching him how to drive the chariot. The 700 classical verses amount to an extended commentary on action in contemplation. Hinduism was not even named when these texts were first written, and almost all of the Indian scriptures were not translated into English or modern languages until the 19th century. Don't dismiss any of these until you have at least tried to read them. You'll find included in the episode notes a few astoundingly parallel passages between sacred texts from Hinduism and sacred texts from Christianity. I hope this short introduction will encourage you to seek much further on your own. For now, let us take this moment to connect to the deep pool of wisdom. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The Bhagavad Gita describes Lord Krishna, one of Hinduism's central gods, as both this and that, totally immanent and yet fully transcendent, physical and yet formless, the deepest inner self and yet the God self. Krishna has even been called the unknown Christ of Hinduism, the same mystery that Western Christians, with their dualistic minds, could not put together in Jesus. Krishna, like Jesus, also shows the integration of action and contemplation. The Bhagavad Gita doesn't counsel that we all become monks or solitaries, but in fact, Lord Krishna tells Prince Arjuna that the true synthesis is found in a lifelong purification of motive, intention, and focus. Precisely in your world of action, which is what makes it contemplative. The Bhagavad Gita calls the active person, which most of us are, to a life of interiority and soul discovery, which is still our major concern today. How can we do pure action? Only by gradually detaching from all the fruits of action and doing everything purely for the love of God. This is what Lord Krishna teaches. I think our Christ says the same thing in several places. For example, Mark 12:30, "You shall love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength." Jesus even counsels the same love toward the neighbor. See Matthew 22:39. Jesus is unitive both vertically and horizontally, illustrated in the geometric image of the cross. The only way to integrate action and contemplation is to go ahead and do your action, but every day to ask yourself why you are doing it. Is it to make money? Is it to have a good reputation? Is it to keep you busy? Or is it for the pure love of Krishna, for the love of God? Only then do you recognize who the doer truly is. I'd like to share a short passage from the Bhagavad Gita for you to reflect on. The wise see that there is action in the midst of inaction, and inaction in the midst of action. Their consciousness is unified, and every act is done with complete awareness. When a man has let go of attachment, when his mind is rooted in wisdom, everything he does is worship, and his actions all melt away. God is the offering. God is the offered, poured out by God. God is attained by all those who see God in every action. In the Bhagavad Gita, Prince Arjuna is the noble individual soul, Atman, and Lord Krishna is the personification of the divine, Brahman. Already in the ancient Vedas, Atman and Brahman were discovered to be one, at least in a foundational sense. This is exactly as Jesus proclaimed when he said, "I and the Father are one," John 10:30. Teresa of Avila begins her journey through the interior castle by proclaiming God's castle and chosen dwelling is precisely the beauty and amplitude of the human soul. Or as the Sufis say, God is love, lover, and beloved all at once. Let us take this moment to connect to the love, lover, and beloved. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence, be still for 1 minute. The practice this week is titled Darshan and Namaste. In the Hindu tradition, Darshan is to behold the divine and allow yourself to be fully seen. Many Hindus visit temples not to see God, but to let God gaze upon them, and then to join God's seeing, which is always unconditional acceptance and compassion. I invite you to spend several minutes with one you love, a human or perhaps a beloved dog, looking into their eyes. Without speaking, simply mirror to each other love and respect through your gaze. During the silence, allow the source of love with you to well up and flow from you. Receive the love flowing from the one gazing at you. It is all one love. Witness the divine presence in both self and the other. Bring your experience of darshan to a close by placing your palms together on your chest, bowing and speaking namaste. Namaste is a familiar Indian greeting which means I bow to you. Or you may prefer to say, the Christ in me sees the Christ in you. Bring this loving gaze and an inner stance of humility and recognition to all you encounter today. Thank you for being with me. May your life be blessed by the presence that God is love, lover, and beloved all at once. Blessings to all.